Segura, please state and spell both your first and last name for the court reporter.
Henry Segura. H-E-N-R-Y-S-E-G-U-R-A.
41-year-old Henry Segura, wearing a navy blue sport coat, a light blue collared shirt, a purple and black plaid tie, and glasses, took the stand on November 13, 2019. At times, his testimony was matter-of-fact, and other times, contentious.
So your testimony is that you told police in this case over the phone...
Investigator Johnson.
Wait a minute, don't interrupt her question, Mr. Segura. Let her finish your question.
She's asking the same question over and over.
Be quiet.
No, she's...
Be quiet.
Henry Segura was being tried for the murder of Brandy Peters and her three children, one of whom was his three-year-old son, Javonte. Prosecutors believe he was the sole killer, but Henry's defense says he's completely innocent. 6 days after Henry would take the stand, on November 19th, 2019, he would leave the courtroom after his trial concluded. But was he a free man, or would he be escorted by deputies? In part one, I went over the prosecution's case against Henry Segura. Here's what we learned. On November 20th, 2010, first responders responded to a home on Saddle Creek Run in Tallahassee, Florida. Inside was the body of Brandy Peters by the entrance of the home, and the bodies of her three children inside the bathtub in the main bathroom. Brandy had been shot multiple times and then beaten with at least one object that, according to a prosecution expert, could have been a gun. The type of gun prosecutors believe was used was a .32 caliber, although the actual murder weapon has never been found. One of Brandy's daughters was shot, and her other two children drowned. According to prosecutors, they believe the murders occurred on November 19th, the night before they were found, between 6:53 p.m. and 8:21 p.m. During their case, prosecutors presented evidence that Henry Segura had lied to investigators and told them that he had not seen Brandy the day of the murders and that he was in fact home the entire day. However, when investigators looked into the cell phone records of a second phone he didn't tell them he had, they discovered that that phone was in the area of Brandy's house right around the time they say she and her children were killed. As for motive, they say Henry owed Brandy more than $20,000 in child support, and he didn't want to pay it. So that was the prosecution's case. And now, in part two, I'll get into the defense's case. They say that Henry Segura is innocent and that the deaths were actually ordered by a Mexican cartel. But before I get into the defense's case, I think it's important to understand how the defense's case came to be. When investigators were combing Brandy's house, the scene of the murders, and looking for evidence, they found letters that had been sent to Brandy from a man named James Carlos Santos, who was an inmate who claimed he ran a drug trafficking operation with the Mexican cartel. They went to interview him, and at first, Santos claimed to not have any knowledge of the case. But through letters to the court, he gradually began saying he was involved, until eventually he said he ordered the hit. Now, I mentioned in part one that this is a retrial, that Henry actually first went to trial in 2017. In a pretrial hearing before Henry's first trial, his defense had argued that DNA found at the scene belonged to Angel Avila, a Colombian drug trafficker, who Santos says was part of his hit squad. But when it came time for Santos to testify in the first trial, he pleaded the fifth. But in another letter to the judge, he said he is now ready to testify. A cartel hit may seem like an unbelievable defense, but is it? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 117, Part 2. Henry Segura told the jury what he did for a living. He was a welder, he explained, and had been for about 15 years or so. He worked for different companies and thus did a lot of traveling from state to state. When he was arrested in Minnesota. And although that's a long way from Tallahassee, where he lived with his wife Malika, he said it wasn't unusual for him to be there for work. Henry told the jury that he and Malika had been married for 10 years. After his infant son, another child he had had with another woman, died, he promised Malika he wouldn't cheat anymore.
I had got caught cheating a lot. I've had a couple of kids outside of my marriage. It made our marriage go up and down a whole lot. I made a bunch of promises that I wouldn't cheat anymore. Once our son, Jalik, died, I made a promise to her that I wouldn't cheat on her anymore, and I tried to not get caught. I actually started cheating back after a few months or so that I made that promise to her, but, you know, I tried harder to not get caught, I guess you could say.
But a couple years before that promise, he was involved with Brandy Peters. He met her at a gas station.
I got a phone number. We started talking on the phone occasionally at night. We had a sexual encounter, and we ended up moving in with each other after that.
He said Brandy's twin daughters, Tamaya and Tanaya, were about 2 years old then. Within a year, he, Brandy, and the kids were living together, and she would have a third child, Javante. He said he was at the hospital when Javante was born and signed the birth certificate. He said he would buy diapers, clothes, and watch Javante whenever he could. Whatever it was a father was supposed to do at the time, I was there, he said. But more than that, he said the twins were actually more like his own kids than Javante. He potty trained them, cooked for them, took them to school, and was their father figure. He and Brandy stopped talking when Javante was about 5 or 6 months old. He had gone to Colorado for work, and he was still married to Malika. It was hard to balance those two relationships, and he just didn't have time for Brandy and her kids anymore. He was asked if there was ever doubt about Javante being his son. He said yes, that on nights that he wouldn't come home to Brandy, she would tell him that Javante has another daddy anyway. When she would make little sly comments like that, he said he would then question if Javante was really his. Henry reiterated what he had told investigators in his interviews, that he had been the one to initiate child support for Javante, so he could stop giving Brandy the cash he was giving her. Brandy didn't want him to do that. She wanted him to just keep giving her cash like how he was. Henry told the jury that he also had a daughter in Orlando, and back in 2006 had to pay child support for her. He said due to the lack of payments he made there, he went to jail and had his driver's license suspended. He said he then met someone who told him that he just has to make minimal payments on it and that nothing would happen then, so he wasn't worried about it anymore. He owed the same amount of money to that woman as he did with Brandy. Henry said he wasn't concerned about the child support judgment for Javante at all. He hadn't even had the chance to make the first payment before she and Javante were killed. He said he wasn't worried because he had documentation that he believed would prove he owed her far less than $20,000. The judgment came down in August of 2010, and he had just gotten shot in July. And while recovering, he didn't have a job. He addressed the text messages Brandy sent him earlier in the week leading up to her murder. He said he forwarded those text messages to his wife so she could see that he had a reason to want to go to Brandy's house and talk with her about it. He went to Brandy's house on Wednesday, as he told investigators. He said he cooled her down. He told her how he had been shot the month prior and wasn't working. He told her that once he got back on his feet, he could start giving her money on a regular basis. He said after their meeting, her tone changed drastically, like it always did. Henry pointed to the text message he got from her the next day, saying that if he wasn't her baby daddy, she would have given him some. He said that made him think that they would go back to how it used to be. He then called her and tried to make plans to come over that day, but she had plans already, so he went over there on Friday instead. On Friday, the day of the murders, he said he arrived around 3 p.m. and parked around the corner so his vehicle wouldn't be seen. He had his second phone on him, the one his wife didn't know about, and the one that he used to talk to his girlfriends. He said Brandy didn't have that number, though, and in fact, he would call her from it and star 67 it because he didn't want her to have it. He said she's the type who would blow his phone up. He told the court that he and Brandy had sex on her bed while the kids were playing outside. He used a condom, he said, and he thinks Brandy then flushed it down the toilet. They then went to the living room to watch TV. The kids came in and he tried to spend some time with Javonte. At some point, the three kids went across the street to eat the oxtail soup that Artron Timmons' stepfather had made. That was around 7-ish, he estimated. When the kids came home, they brought Brandy a plate and she ate it. That was around 7:30, he said. They continued watching TV and he left between 8 and 8:15. He told Brandy that he needed to go, and he said she made some sort of sly remark about having company coming over anyway. Henry said he went home after that and remained home. His wife and two sons were there. They watched a movie together, he said, and he was texting one of his other girlfriends, Natasha, at the time. When asked if he deleted any of his text messages, he said he would delete the ones from Brandy because he didn't want his wife to see them. After the murders, he went in to be interviewed by police. He said he was very uncomfortable while at the police station.
I don't know. It's just that, you know, black man sitting in the police station, I just felt awkward, felt weird the whole time I was there.
Henry also told the jury about how he got shot in July of 2010.
I was working in Alabama at the time, and my cousin was in Long Beach, Mississippi, and he called me and told me that, that he was having an issue with some guys out there and wanted to know if I could have his back. So I was like an hour, hour and a half away, 2 hours from where he was. So I drove down there to make sure that he was okay. And, you know, one thing led to another. One of the guys pulled a firearm and started shooting, and me and my cousin ducked behind the truck or whatever and started shooting too.
Okay. What weapon were you shooting with at that time?
I had a .32 revolver.
He said he was shot in the chest, about an inch under his heart. He said he gave his gun, a .32 caliber, to his cousin. He didn't want police to find it on him when he went to the hospital to be treated. Henry said he found out about the murders the day after. When he took his son to get his hair braided, the girl who braids his hair told him that Brandy had been killed and that the kids were found in the bathtub. Henry's attorney, Nate Prince, asked him why he didn't show any emotion when told by police that his son Javonte was in fact dead. He said he was raised to show no emotion by his father. Prince also asked him about lies he told during the interview.
I'm in the police station. The officer, Lewis, I believe his name, he's asking me 100 times, did you see Brandy? Did you talk to Brandy? Did you talk to Brandy? What about these other girls? What about these other? I'm like, man, I didn't talk to anybody. I'm not cheating my wife. I ain't talked to nobody. I ain't talked to no other female, no nothing. If I would have just told him, look, yes, I was cheating my wife. I was talking to Brandy. I talked to Natasha. I talked to Kim. I talked to all these different females. Then I think he would have seen it. I was telling the truth. And, you know, like I said, I wouldn't be here today.
That's what you think in retrospect.
That's what I feel.
In retrospect. But you, at the time, you lied to him, right?
Yes. Because I honestly didn't think that me lying to him about having sex with a bunch of different women would, you know, result in me being arrested for murder.
You told your attorney that you didn't commit these murders.
I told the world I didn't commit these murders.
Okay. Why wouldn't you?
You say, why wouldn't I?
Right.
Because I have no reason whatsoever to kill my son or those twins. Neither Brandy.
So you just have no reason to do it?
No reason whatsoever. I wouldn't. What would I kill a child for?
Okay.
Let alone children.
State Attorney Sarah Dugan cross-examined Henry. She asked him about how he said the twins were like his daughters at one point. She pointed out that he didn't ask police in the interviews how they died. I already knew how they died, he said. He said his friend had told him that the kids were found in the tub. He assumed that they had drowned, he said. He didn't find out that one of them was shot until later.
Isn't it true that, I mean, you really couldn't have cared less about Javonte?
That's very untrue.
He was nothing but a drain on your bank account. Right?
No, how could he have been just a drain on my bank account if I never paid the child support that they was ordering me to pay?
I mean, evidently you're saying you're paying all this money under the table to Brandy through money orders and papers and all these things.
Yeah, Pampers don't cost anything. And I was only giving her like $100 here, $100 there.
Well, so it was nothing major. Question. You were conscious about the fact that he was a drain on your bank account. You were getting hassled by DOR. You were being asked for a lot of money for him, right? By everybody.
Yeah, I was being asked
by Brandy, by DOR, by everybody, right?
DOR is the only people who, yes.
Dugan asked why the jury should believe anything he's saying now. He said the evidence speaks for itself.
So the fact that you had a .32 revolver, your DNA's on the bathtub bar, you were located there before Brandy's phone went off the network forever, all that evidence speaks for itself, right?
My DNA was not on the bathtub bar. That's something he made up.
Okay.
Dugan then started pointing out inconsistencies between what Henry said during the police interviews and his testimony in court. He admitted that he and Brandy had arguments about child support, contrary to what he told police.
And you told police in your second interview that you and Miss Peters never had an argument about child support. The questions that you're being asked are in orange and your statements are in yellow. They ask, tell me about the argument that you and Brandy had about child support. The argument we had about child support, you said? We didn't have an argument about child support. Apparently, she's telling people you did. You say, no, we never had an argument about child support. You said that, didn't you?
Yes.
That's not true, is it?
Of course not. No, it's not true.
In reality, she was actually threatening to have you thrown in jail for not paying child support for Jamonte,
yes.
Wasn't she?
Plenty of times, yes.
And she was actually doing that just 3 days before she was murdered, right?
She was doing it, yes. Probably, I don't remember the exact time, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was leading up until the time that everything happened.
Dugan asked why Henry was laughing during some parts of the interview.
You were laughing a lot in that interview. What was so funny?
Nothing was funny. It's just my character. It's how I break the tension whenever I'm having a conversation with someone that I really don't know. And not comfortable speaking with.
Okay. So I guess your answer is you were laughing because you were uncomfortable?
I was laughing because I was a black man locked in a room with two guys with guns that were questioning me about stuff that I had no idea as to what was going on.
Well, I mean, you're here in court today. There's men in the rooms with guns. You're not laughing today.
Well, it's totally different because I have my family around me. I have people who love me and support me, and this is a totally different situation.
Henry also acknowledged that he had lied to police about how he was shot. He had said it happened during a robbery. He acknowledged also lying about where he was the day of the murders.
Now we have her secret cell phone location. So you can't go with the I was at home all night story anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So you're telling us that you were at Brandy's house the evening of the murders, right?
Yes.
And you're telling us the reason that you lied to the police about your location was because you and Brandy had sex that day or that evening, and you did not want your wife to find out about it, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So why didn't you just admit to police then that you were over at Brandy's house to see your son and just leave out the part about sex?
Because I had already told my wife I was going to be home all day working on my vehicles, and I didn't want her to know I was at Brandy's house, period, any time of that day.
Okay, but she knew that you weren't at home working on your cars. She was home and you weren't there, right?
Yeah, she didn't know where I was or what was going on.
Okay, well, why not just tell the police that you were over at Brandy's and just leave out the sex part?
I could have. I guess I wasn't thinking that at the time.
So just wasn't thinking about it? That was your reasoning?
Yes. All I was thinking about was my wife not finding out. I was just having sex with my ex-girlfriend.
Dugan pointed out that Henry's wife, Malika, had since divorced him in 2016 while he was in jail. She questioned why he didn't then contact the police to let them know that he was at Brandy's on the day of the murders. Henry said he did talk to Investigator Johnson about that. Now, this exchange with the prosecutor ended up with quite an admonishment from the judge and quite a reaction from Henry.
And so your answer is no, that you did not tell police that.
Yes, I told the lady Johnson, Investigator Johnson.
You told
over
her
the phone that I was cheating on my wife. I didn't want y'all to find out. Mm-hmm. And she, like I say, she went back and forth and we was arguing about, she know I killed my son. we're gonna arrest you for killing your son, and I hung up on him.
So your testimony is that you told police in this case over the phone,
Investigator Johnson.
Wait a minute, don't interrupt her question, Mr. Skirt. Let her finish her question.
She's asking the same question over and over.
Be quiet.
No, she's...
Be quiet. Now, she asks you a question. You wait till she finishes.
I'm a grown man.
And then answer it, okay? Yeah. And she won't interrupt your answer either. Because the court reporter can't take down two people at once. Is that clear? Sir?
Yeah, that's very clear.
All right.
What we saw right there, you have a little bit of a temper, right?
I'm getting aggravated. You keep asking me the same questions over and over like you're expecting a different answer.
Okay. And we know that, and I mean, you'd probably be the first one to tell us this. Brandy, she tells you what's on her mind. She's not one to hold her tongue, right?
Neither am I.
Okay. Is that kind of what has started this whole thing?
No, we were two people that we got along great. We had arguments. We fuss, we fight, we have sex, we make up. It was actually a pretty good relationship.
Can't imagine you'd be too happy about her saying she's going to put you in jail, calling your mama a bitch, doing all those things we saw in the text messages.
Yeah, Tamika, my first baby mama, did the exact same thing. And we went through the same exact thing. I didn't go and try to kill my child because of that.
The defense called some of Brandy's neighbors to the stand. Dahana Scott was Brandy's next-door neighbor. She testified that she got home the night of the murders around 11 p.m. and that there was a white SUV parked in Brandy's driveway. She said around 2 a.m., her dog, whom she keeps outdoors, started pacing and barking along the fence line towards Brandy's house. He did this for quite a while, she said, calling it abnormal for him and saying that he only does that if he hears something. On cross, she said she didn't hear any gunshots, just the dog. Darius Mount, another one of Brandy's neighbors, said he got home from work around 1:15 a.m. He said he heard a dog barking very vigorously, which was out of the ordinary for their quiet neighborhood. It was so unusual that he called the police to see what was going on.
I mean, it was loud, so, and it was different.
I'm sorry.
Not what I'm used to.
That's what I was going to ask. That had never happened before. The dog had never been going crazy to the point where you guys were worried and called the police, right?
Absolutely.
Marquise Davis lived across the street from Brandy Peters with his wife Cecily and stepson Artron Timmons. He said around 6:30 or 7 p.m., Tamaya, Tanaya, and Javante came over and ate that oxtail soup that he made. They ate for about a half hour or so, and then he sent some home with the kids for Brandy. Marquise said he left to take his father some food, and when he returned to the neighborhood around 8:30 or 9 p.m., he saw a black or dark blue Suburban in Brandy's driveway. He had never seen that vehicle before. He testified that he was familiar with who Henry Segura was back then and would see him coming and going from Brandy's house, but that Suburban was not his. Cecily Timmons, Marquise's wife and Artron's mom, told the court that she and Brandy were friends. She said Brandy came over to her house the day before the murders and showed Cecily an envelope with a letter inside that she had received.
Ms. Timmons, when Ms. Peters came over, and I don't want you to tell us what your conclusions were about her attitude or mood, but can you describe physically what you saw Brandy acting like?
She was scared.
Again, I don't want your conclusion about it. I'd like to ask you about what you observed. How did you observe Brandy acting?
Nervous.
Why do you say that?
I mean, she clearly was nervous because of the letter.
The letter was from James Santos, she said. During prior proceedings, Cecily was subpoenaed by the state. She said she refused to appear and had to be forced to. She said she was scared, but not of Henry or anyone connected to him. She wasn't allowed to testify as to the contents of the letter. The defense called Gregory Washington to the stand, and it didn't exactly start off smoothly.
Mr. Washington, can you please spell both your first and last name?
I'm not testifying.
State your name, please, sir.
Gregory Washington, but I'm not testifying.
The judge instructed Prince to ask him a question. Prince asked him if back in 2010 he had a criminal offense pending. "I'm not testifying," Washington repeated. The judge ordered the jury to leave the room. Outside the presence of the jury, the judge told him he has already given this testimony once before, at Henry's initial trial. "So what's the issue today?" he asked.
"You got no live TV."
"Well, you were on live TV last
night." "I know. I'm not testifying."
"Well, you've already given this testimony once."
"I'm not testifying."
The judge asked Prince how he wants to proceed. Prince said he would prefer Washington testified live. Washington said he's concerned with being labeled a confidential informant and has concerns about his family after his last testimony. The judge ruled that his prior testimony can be used. At Henry's first trial, Gregory Washington testified that two of his friends, DeMario Paramore and Hayward Griffin, were responsible for the murders. As you may recall from part one, the defense said in their opening statements that DeMario Paramore and Hayward Griffin were part of the hit squad hired by James Carlos Santos to carry out the murders. Washington said he worked as a confidential informant with the Tallahassee Police Department, wore a wiretap, and recorded what he called a confession from Paramore. Sergeant Vincent Basio, a homicide investigator with the Tallahassee Police Department, testified that he investigated DeMario Paramore and Hayward Griffin. He said he conducted search warrants on their residences and interviewed them. He testified that he also worked with Gregory Washington, the confidential informant, and listened in as Washington wore a wire.
"While the confidential informant was talking to Mr. Paramore, did Mr. Paramore allude to the fact that he had some participation in the murders of Brandi Peters and her children?"
"He did make a statement, yes."
"Okay. And during the same conversation with the confidential informant, Mr. Paramore explained the reason for killing the children as, 'You don't leave any witnesses, dead men don't talk,' correct?"
That's what he said.
Griffin and Paramore were ultimately arrested on other charges, not related to this case. Sergeant Basio was asked if he was provided names of alibi witnesses who Paramore said could place him away from the murders, his wife and child. Basio said yes, although he didn't interview them. Basio said he obtained a buccal swab from Paramore, and it was sent off to the crime lab in 2016, after Henry's defense gave them a hard time about not doing anything with it. He acknowledged that he also only obtained phone records later in the investigation.
"Is the reason that you didn't follow up on those investigative leads, talking to alibi witnesses or sending off a buccal swab to FDLE or getting phone records contemporaneous with your investigation into these murders, that you basically felt that Mr. Paramore was full of it as it pertained to his confession?"
"After the interview with Mr. Paramore, it was evident through the cooperation and things that he provided that he was not the person that we were looking at."
"So, yes, without any corroboration, you basically just had a feeling that he was full of it when he confessed. Is that fair to say?"
"No. Again, we did corroborate a lot of evidence through cell phone records. There was plenty of court orders done, including his girlfriend's, everyone that was on Brandi Peters' cell phone. So all those cell sites and court orders, they were done prior to. That's the reason why, at the end of the interview, that we decided that he was not our main suspect."
"Cooperation, not that you felt he was full of it? That he was cooperative, I mean to say, not that you personally felt he was full of it."
"He was cooperative, that's correct."
"Okay. Do you recall in your deposition being asked, 'So if his DNA, which you provided, is never compared to exclude him as a witness, and his cell phone data is never obtained to exclude him as a witness, and none of his alibi witnesses are ever questioned to exclude him as a witness, how is he so easily dismissed after having confessed? And if it's just as simple as you've been doing this forever and you could tell based on your interview that he was obviously full of it, that's fine. I just want to know how he was so easily," and you interrupted and said, "Yeah." I said, "That's pretty much it." And you said, "That pretty much sums it up." You recall that?
"Yes."
"So it was essentially based on the fact that you simply felt he was full of it, correct?"
"The totality of circumstances, yes."
On cross-examination, Sergeant Basio called Washington an unreliable informant He said the only reason he was utilized in this case was because it involved the deaths of Brandy and three children. Extraordinary circumstances. Sergeant Basio also told the court that in the wiretap recording, Paramore didn't say he was the one who did the killing. Basio said that there is no evidence that he was involved and that the buccal swab showed he wasn't there. Prince then questioned him on redirect.
I want to ask you specifically because although the audio is inaudible, you could actually hear what was being said throughout the entire interaction between confidential informant and target, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so when Mr. Fuchs asked you a minute ago, you know, there wasn't any statement specifying that Mr. Paramore was involved. That wasn't accurate, correct? Mr. Paramore specifically alluded to the fact that he had some participation in the murders. Is that true?
Again, he didn't say he, but he did end up saying that statement that we talked about.
You wrote a police report, right?
Yes.
Do you recall writing in your police report, Paramore alluded to the fact that he had some participation in these murders?
Based on the statement, yes, sir.
Right. That's what I was asking.
Okay. But yeah.
Okay.
The defense recalled quite a few of the state's witnesses to the stand. One of them was Officer Candace Jernigan, who was one of the first responding officers to the scene. She testified for the defense and said she spoke with Monica, Brandy's sister, the day after the murders, and that Monica did tell her that she last spoke to Brandy at 10 p.m. on the night of the murders. On cross-examination, Officer Jernigan was asked if she ever told anyone that the children had drowned, and she said no. Neither she nor any other law enforcement at the scene knew how the kids had died. She said they also didn't tell anyone where the kids had been found. Wearing a navy prison jumpsuit and glasses, James Carlos Santos, who introduced himself as just James Santos, took the stand.
Did you know Brandy Peters?
Yes, sir.
How did you know her?
I met her around 2000 or 2001.
Okay. And what was the nature of your relationship with Ms. Peters?
She transported narcotics for me.
How did she do that?
She would pick up a car in Atlanta or here in Tallahassee and drive to Texas.
How did she become involved transporting drugs for you after you met her?
After having conversations with her a couple of times, I asked her, would she like to make some money?
And okay. Did you already have an existing drug trafficking organization?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay. Was she one of multiple people who transported illegal narcotics for you?
Yes, sir, she was.
He said Brandy would go to Texas to get the drugs, either with someone else or by herself, and she would then transport them to Atlanta, Chicago, or right there in Tallahassee. Santos told the jury that at some point he was arrested and went to prison, but he continued directing his drug trafficking organization from behind bars. He was able to do that through his cell phone, mail, and jail visits.
I guess let me cut to the chase and then I'll come back and ask some additional questions about it. At some point, did you end up directing associates of yours to kill Brandy Peters?
Yes, sir, I did.
And why was that?
She had stolen money and drugs.
Okay. Without going into the nature of any communications, how was it that you found that out?
I contacted an associate of mine and he informed me.
He said the drugs came from Colombia, were then transported to Mexico, and then to Texas. On the Colombian supply side, his point of contact was Angel Avila, who dealt with the Colombians and made sure the drugs got to Mexico. Then he said his guys in the Los Zetas Mexican cartel would then get them to the border of Texas, and he would get them from there and distribute them in the U.S. In order to get the hit on Brandy done, he said he first had to get some people here in Tallahassee. He brought in guys from Texas and Atlanta, and then assigned them to get some local guys to assist. He said he doesn't remember the names of the local guys. Prince showed him a letter that he had sent to the court addressing his involvement in the murders. Santos read through it and said that one of the local guys was called Jit, but his real name was something Paramore. He said a friend of his knew Paramore. Santos told the court that seven people were involved in carrying out the hit. Prince said Santos has made multiple inconsistent statements about his role in the case over many years. Santos agreed.
Why is that? What I mean by that is you haven't always admitted that you actually ordered the hit. It's taken a lot of time for you to come forward with that information. You've provided progressively more details over years. Why is that?
Quite a few reasons. For one, I didn't want to be charged. And for two, I wanted to make sure that it was feasible for me and my organization. At first, you know, they didn't have a problem with the situation. But once they began to believe that it's possible that I might have been involved in her thievery, then I had to let it be known that I'm the reason why she's no longer here.
So your associates, your concern was your associates, I want to make sure I'm understanding you, believed or may have believed that you were involved in her theft.
You know, when you bring a person in your organization, when they work for you, you're responsible for them. I vouch for them. They didn't know her other than through me. So I let them know that she was a reliable person. She was loyal and whatnot.
So why now are you willing to take the stand, admit under oath in open court that you directed these murders to take place?
Well, because I'm on an active yard in the U.S. penitentiary, and, you know, being known as someone who stole from a cartel, and I'm on the compound with them. In fact, one of them was my roommate. So that could be very dangerous for me if I didn't.
He was asked if he ever met Angel Avila, his contact on the Colombian side. He said he thinks he did twice. When asked what language they spoke, he said English. Avila can understand English, he said. The first time he met with Avila was to establish some runs coming out of Laredo. The second time was about some money issues they had.
Through some means, cell phone or letter or runner, you communicated directions to some folks to have Brandy killed. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
Prince showed him an envelope and asked if he recognized it. He said yes. He identified his writing on the envelope.
Is this the envelope that contained a letter that you sent to Brandy Peters?
Yes, sir.
And what date did you send this envelope?
November the 17th, 2010.
Is this your writing on the other side of the envelope as well?
Yes.
So this is the envelope containing the letter that you sent to Brandy Peters, I guess, 2 days before her murder?
Yes.
James Santos was cross-examined by prosecutor John Fuchs. Fuchs first asked how old Brandy was when he met her, in 2000 or 2001, he had said. Santos said he doesn't know. He didn't ask how old she was. He was asked to describe what she looked like. He said she was a dark-skinned black woman. Fuchs asked a few more questions about what Brandy looked like, including how tall she was. Santos said he doesn't remember.
This was a long time ago, so...
Sure, but you had this girl killed. You don't remember how old she was? You don't remember what she looked like?
No.
Not at all. This girl that ran drugs for you all these years. You don't remember what she looked like? You don't remember how tall she was?
I just told you what she looked like. She was a dark-skinned black woman.
He said Brandy was one of maybe 100 people who were running drugs for him, so he didn't remember much about how she looked. Regarding his first meeting with Angel Avila, he said he believes it was in 2001 at Farley's Strip Club on Buford Highway in Atlanta. He described Avila as a tall, skinny Colombian guy that he met through his friend, Carlos. He said he and Carlos met up with Avila at the strip club and that it was a long night where they mostly discussed drugs and money. He said he then met Avila again sometime before he got arrested. They met at a place called Grandma's Biscuits in Atlanta. They talked for a while there and then went to a flea market where Carlos had a business. He talked to Avila again when they were both in prison and before Avila got deported, sometime between 2003 and 2009. He said they were able to talk via a conference call and they spoke for maybe 3 minutes. He said he needed to ask him a question about some narcotics. Avila didn't give him the info he wanted, and he never personally talked to him again. He said once he got to prison, he spoke with Brandy regularly on the phone. She didn't come visit him, but one of her friends, Shakia, did. He was asked when he learned about Brandy stealing money from them. He said it was around 2008 or 2009 when things started to go bad. Brandy owed him around $90,000. Fuchs asked where he would keep that kind of money. He said he would move it around from people to people and stash the money. One of his stash places were in quite a few houses in Atlanta, he said.
Atlanta's a big city. Where in Atlanta?
The Fulton County area.
I'm sorry?
The Fulton County area.
The Fulton County area?
Yes.
Where in the Fulton County area?
I mean, what do you want? Like an exact address?
Yeah.
Or something? I don't know the exact address.
Don't know the exact address. Well, all this hundreds of thousands of dollars that are being stashed.
No.
Not a very good leader of this group if you don't know where your money's being stashed.
No. I keep good records.
Obviously not. You don't even know where it is.
I got it recorded. I got records.
I'm sorry?
I have records. I write everything down. I have a secretary.
You have a secretary?
Of course, yes,
sir. Does the... I guess you're in federal prison now, right?
Yes, sir.
Does the federal prison system supply you with a secretary?
No. No, sir. My secretary is free. I'm incarcerated.
He said his secretary is his associate Carlos's sister. Fuchs asked him what Carlos's last name is, and he said Hernandez. His sister is Selena Hernandez. In order to place the hit on Brandy, Santos said he wanted to be transferred to the federal prison in Tallahassee, because it would be easier to do it from there. To do that, he threatened the governor, he said.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
All right, so you threatened the governor then to make sure that you could be transferred to the Florida State, from Florida State Prison to the prison there.
The federal prison.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. When did you threaten the governor?
I think I wrote the first letter maybe in 2009.
2009?
Yes. It took maybe three times before they actually, the FDLE came to the prison, saw me, interviewed me and whatnot. And about 4 months after that, the U.S. Marshals came and picked me up from the prison and transported me to Capitol Circle.
Okay. All right. And you felt that you had to get to the federal prison in order to, communicate better with your people?
Yes, sir.
Now, I want to stop here for a second, because even the prosecutor sounds incredulous at Santos's claim that he threatened the governor. But according to reports, Santos was held in a federal prison in Kentucky for threatening to have former Florida governor, Charlie Crist, and the Fulton County DA killed. Now, according to this report, he was threatening them because he wanted them to release a man who had been convicted of a murder that Santos said he really committed. But Santos is now saying he was threatening them in order to be moved to federal prison so he could order Brandy's murder. Okay, back to his testimony. After his transfer to federal prison, Santos said he was able to order the hit, and he ordered it by contacting his associate, Carlos.
So you contacted Carlos?
Yes.
Hey, Carlos, I gotta have this girl taken out.
Yes.
Okay. You tell him who she was?
Yes.
Okay. What'd you tell him?
I told him about the girl that I hired in, out of Tallahassee. He knew her, so it wasn't like he didn't know who she was.
Okay, so he had met Carlos. He had met Brandy before.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. So you tell Carlos, we're done. We got to take her out.
Yes.
All right. So what happens next?
They put together a team to carry out what I wanted done.
All right. How did they pick out that team?
Well, there's quite a few ways this has to happen. There's a lot of people that had vested interests in what had taken place. She not only stole from me, but other people. So,
okay.
All of these groups got together and decided that this had to happen. And then, you know, I gave her an opportunity to at least give us some of the money or some of the product back before we did this, because she had been good to me while I was on the street, so I didn't want to be too hasty, just, you know, pull the plug. But
so it's all these groups then that decided to take out Miss Peters?
Yes, all of us that work together, the Lords, the Zetas, yes.
He said Carlos is a member of Los Zetas, and he is a board member of the Vice Lords. Santos told the jury that the 7-person hit squad included 2 to 3 guys from Tallahassee, three to four from Chicago, and one from Atlanta. He was asked who they were. He said the female was from Chicago. He doesn't remember her name. And the other guys were Jit, or Paramour, Angel Avila, and he said Carlos picked the rest of them.
What'd you tell him to do?
Well, I instructed them to kill her for robbing us, pretty much.
Okay. Give me any other instructions?
Yes. They were supposed to dig up her yard to see if she had any money or drugs buried, but that didn't happen.
Supposed to dig up her yard, make sure there's no money or drugs buried?
Yes.
Okay. So they must have had a prop shovel with them then, right?
I assume so.
Okay. All right.
Fuchs asked him if he told them when to do it, and he said no. He was trying to get Brandy to go to Atlanta for Thanksgiving, but there was a conflict in schedules. He wanted to do it there instead of at her home, but he couldn't get her to leave.
So you were trying to get her to go to Atlanta?
Yes. I promised her a car. Mercedes.
And she wasn't having any of it?
No.
She didn't want any association with you at all, did she?
No.
So instead, the group had to travel to Tallahassee to do it. He said he doesn't know the specifics.
What did they tell you afterwards?
About a day after she was murdered, the cops came to my unit and took me to the hole, to the shoe.
To the what?
To the shoe, special housing unit.
Okay.
I stayed there a couple of weeks. And then some detectives came to saw me.
Okay.
He spoke to Carlos about the murders months later. Fuchs showed him a report from a Dr. Brady Hudson from 2017. Dr. Hudson's conclusion was that Santos had delusional disorder, grandiose type, and prominent narcissistic and antisocial personality traits. Another report Fuchs showed him said that Santos had told the doctors that he had been in a mental hospital before. Santos said that's a common practice in prison, to claim you need to go to the psych ward because that's where all the women worked. Fuchs then asked him about another murder he had confessed to, a murder Fuchs said he couldn't have committed because he was in prison at the time.
Isn't it true that during that incarceration, you contacted the Federal Bureau of Investigation and told them that you had committed a murder and were involved in the shooting of a cop in March of 2000 in Atlanta, Georgia?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
All right. And you couldn't have because you were in prison in Nevada, right?
No, sir. I got out of prison in 2000 in February. I was on house arrest when the murder took place. You might want to check that out. I was on house arrest. I was staying at 2380 Jernigan Street, Southwest Atlanta.
You just said that you were incarcerated in Las Vegas in 1997 through December of 2000.
I went back to prison after that shooting. I was violated and sent back to prison after the police shooting. That's why it says BP by my name. That's parole violation.
He agreed that another man had since been arrested and convicted for that murder, but insisted he did it. Fuchs asked him if it's true that he also confessed to two other murders in which there was never a dead body associated with them, one in Miami and one in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. You sent some investigators to see me. I didn't really want to talk to them.
Okay.
I don't talk to the state. I'm on an active compound. We're not allowed to talk to state investigators or state prosecutors or any of that.
You're not?
No.
You don't want to talk to state prosecutors, state investigators?
No, sir.
Okay. Certainly write plenty of letters to the court.
Yes, to the judge and to the defense, but not to the state.
Yeah. And in that, you confess to two murders, one in Miami, one in Kentucky, in which there were no dead persons by those names.
You mean in a letter?
No.
Oh.
He told investigators about
it. Oh, yeah, I didn't want to talk to the guy. I told him that before we even had the conversation.
He said he told the investigator he didn't want to have anything to do with him, and he just made it up. Prosecutor Fuchs then went over Santos's criminal history with him, which included about 8 incarcerations, none of which, Fuchs pointed out, were for drugs. They were all for theft, crimes of dishonesty, and armed robbery. Santos countered that he had one drug charge from 1989. Fuchs then asked him about something he told investigator Basio when he was first interviewed about the murders.
Back in 2010, 2011, you were contacted by law enforcement about this case, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you told investigator Basio that you did not have Randy killed, that you actually met her through Kalo Green, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And that you were actually surprised she had been murdered. Well, you told law enforcement officer investigator Basio, right?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
All right. And she was actually going to marry you, is what you told investigator Basio back in 2010, 2011.
Yeah, I don't recall that.
You don't recall that?
No, sir.
Okay. And she was actually going to travel to Atlanta to get a new car for you. I think you told us that.
That's the truth.
Yes. Okay. All right.
He agreed that he also told investigators at one point that a man named Leon had committed the killings. Santos said he didn't testify to that because Leon was actually not a part of the hit squad and was in prison at the time. Fuchs also confronted him about an inconsistency regarding his secretary's name.
And you told us earlier your secretary's name was what?
Selena.
Selena what?
Hernandez. Yes.
Isn't it true you previously told the court?
Selena Alderman.
Yeah.
Different name there.
It's the same woman. She was married. She got a divorce. She's back Hernandez. Same lady.
Oh, okay. Figured you'd have an answer for that one.
Santos agreed that he had lied many times to investigators and that at first he didn't outright admit to ordering the murders.
Mr. Santos, isn't it true that in this particular case you heard about the homicides?
No, sir. That's not true.
You hear about the homicides, and then you see publicity involving someone by the name of Angel Avila, and you decided at that point you were going to admit that you had involvement in this, and you sent Angel Avila in there to kill her, right?
No, sir.
Fuchs pointed out that in his testimony on direct, Santos said he had met Brandy at a mall. In 2015, he said he met her at a Wendy's. Santos said they met in the Wendy's parking lot and then went to the mall.
Oh, so now we've gone from, we didn't meet her at the mall, we met her at Wendy's and then went to the mall.
Yes, we went from Wendy's parking lot to Governor Square Mall.
It seems to me, Mr. Santos, that you're adopting your story and what you're telling this jury to fit the facts as they're presented to you to try and answer every question you can.
No, sir.
Fuchs said that Santos only said he was involved after hearing that Angel Avila's DNA was found in the case, and a hearing was held to determine whether that would be admissible. It was only then, he said, when Santos came forward claiming he knew Avila and had ordered the hit.
Much like whenever you admitted first time for these murders and said that Angel Avila was involved in these murders after you saw that there was a court proceeding having to do with the name of Angel Avila, correct?
No, sir. I never actually saw a court proceeding. So you must understand that when these murders took place, I was placed in confinement, which means I had no access to my my email and then, or newspaper.
And then in August of 2017, there was another court proceeding, was there not?
2017?
August 2017.
Yes, sir.
Early August 2017.
Yes, sir.
At which time there was another name that came forward, Mr. Paramore, the person you called Jit, right?
Yes, sir.
And then it wasn't until after that, in August 17th, that all of a sudden you wrote a letter to Judge Hankton saying that Paramore was the person that you, one of the persons that you ordered to kill.
No, that's not entirely true.
That's not?
No. I pled the fifth before Paramore even came to court, sir. The reason
but you
why,
never mentioned the name DeMario Paramore. In fact, you can't even remember his name now until you wrote that letter after the court proceeding in which Mr. Paramore's name came up during court, correct?
I don't recall when I actually wrote the letter, but I do recall that when he became a part of this court proceeding, I played the fifth, thinking that he may implement me and my organization more.
Fuchs then questioned whether Carlos, the man Santos said was his associate and who helped carry out the murders, actually even exists.
And you say your person that you had contact with is named Carlos.
Yes, sir.
You introduced your name here today as James Santos, correct?
Yes, sir.
Isn't it true your middle name is Carlos? You are Carlos, are you not?
You mean Carlos Hernandez? Or no, I'm Carlos Santos.
On redirect, Henry's attorney, Nate Prince, showed the jury another mental evaluation report for Santos from 2017, where it says Santos has no mental illnesses. Prince asked him again why he was testifying.
My objective here is basically to clear my name with my organization so that I can walk a clear compound and not have to go into protective custody, which I haven't done my entire sentence.
So the point of your testimony is to let your organization know that you weren't responsible for the thefts?
Exactly.
Prince then asked if he was communicating with Brandy via the U.S. mail in the days leading up to her murder. He said yes. He sent a letter to her house almost every day in the 10 days leading up to her death.
Mr. Santos, the letters themselves appear superficially incomprehensible. What were you trying to accomplish with this?
A lot of the letters are pretty much coded. I was trying, you know, in federal prison, you can't seal your mail. Your mail is read going out and coming in. So you have to be very careful on what you write and how you write it.
So with respect to the kind of incomprehensible language, what is it that you were trying to communicate through the coded messages?
In some of my letters, I was explaining about exotic cars. If you notice, I spoke about cars that were at our disposal for rental to let her know that the business was still being conducted. And in a couple of my letters, I was speaking about money that was moved around or money that was owed by her. And in one of, I think it was an email I might have sent where I was talking about, in one of the letters I explained about money that if she could return $50,000 and take one trip, then the debt would be paid. I had the car waiting for her in Atlanta. I was looking for her to take the trip before Thanksgiving of 2010.
I see. So when you're talking about a car, those are things that you're promising to Miss Peters in order to get her to go to Atlanta?
Yes.
He said he was also communicating with Brandy via email from custody. He said he was using another inmate's account, but he doesn't remember his name. He identified the email exchanges in court.
So again, in these emails, you're referencing that she'll be given $50,000 cash in a Mercedes-Benz.
Yes, sir.
Is that what you were promising her if she would do this trip to Atlanta?
Yes, sir.
And there's also, you're also requesting that she get a hold of somebody who you were claiming was your father, a Dr. Yusuf Ali Bey.
Yes, Dr. Yusuf Ali Bey passed away in 2003, so that was a whole nother spiel. That wasn't getting directly in contact with him. He was already dead.
So what did that mean then? What were you trying
to do? His son, Yusuf Bey the Fourth, was the guy that that handled a lot of my business. I was trying to get her to get in contact with him, actually.
Was he one of the people that you anticipated being involved in her murder?
No, he's one of the people that I anticipated being able to get her to pay back the money.
I see. So even as late as November, you were still willing to try to have her pay the debt off. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
He said if she had gone to Atlanta like he was requesting, more than likely she would have been killed. He was trying to recoup money and kill her, he explained. Prince asked about why he gave false confessions before, about other murders.
And have you made false confessions before?
I think so, yes, to a detective, to a state detective.
Why did you do that?
For one, I didn't want to talk to him. That's the one thing. And another, I feel as if they feel that I'm sort of unbalanced or whatnot, then they wouldn't charge me. At the time, I didn't want to be charged. So if they felt that I was unstable, they wouldn't take me serious and charge me with this crime.
So you're both trying to let your associates know that you took care of the debt?
Took care of the business, and at the same time, finding leeway for myself.
Dr. Jesse De La Cruz, a consultant and gang expert, testified about Mexican cartels and how they react when money is stolen from them.
The Mexican cartels do not take
the loss of merchandise very lightly. Somebody is going to pay somehow, whether it's the individual who was in charge of the operation on the street level, or many times, for example, let's say that I'm dealing with the cartels and I'm the guy in charge of, and they give me, let's say, 10 kilos of cocaine, and somehow I get arrested and I lose it. They will generally kill my whole family to let everybody else know this is not acceptable. You know, somebody's going to pay.
Prince asked about the involvement of a female in a group sent to kill someone. As you'll recall, one of the prosecution's experts did testify that there was unknown female DNA under Brandy's fingernails.
The woman is used because if somebody knocks on the door and it's a female, pretty much people on the other side of the door are going to be less worried or careful because it's a woman. But the woman is used to so that they will open the door, that so others can rush in. That's what the woman's used for, not to commit the murder itself, only to help them gain entry.
De La Cruz said he spoke to a family member of his who had been in the Las Zetas cartel about what symbols they use and if a spade or shovel is one of them.
He indicated in Spanish, es el las de espadas, which means in the cards, it's an ace of spade. Now, he said that the Zetas have a military background. And he said that the ace of spade in the military in Mexico indicates death. And so that is the manner in which they send the message, the Zetas, through that ace of spade to other people, underworld people, that it was them and that if you mess with us, this was going to happen.
De La Cruz said that based on the evidence he reviewed, he feels that the murders in this case were the result of a hit from the Las Zetas.
Everything that I reviewed points directly towards the Zetas.
On cross, De La Cruz admitted that he has 5 prior felony convictions. He also said he charges $200 an hour and has billed $26,000 to the defense so far, not including travel there and testimony. He agreed that he has never testified for the state or federal governments. Investigator Mark Lewis from the Tallahassee Police Department was another witness who had testified for the state and who was now being recalled by the defense. He told the court that about a week after the murders, investigators responded to Jack McLean Park. There's a picnic pavilion and bathhouse there, and they discovered a trash can that was on fire. Inside the trash can were a number of items found: a t-shirt with suspected blood on it, a collared shirt, a bunch of latex gloves with suspected blood on them, and a set of gray gloves with suspected blood. On cross, investigator Lewis said he learned that the park was cleaned on a daily basis, and since these were found a week after the murders, they determined they had nothing to do with the homicide. On redirect, investigator Lewis admitted that he never called anyone from the Parks and Rec to see if trash cans had been switched out, but he said he knew that they were supposed to be. Prince pointed out that it was Thanksgiving week, to which he agreed. The park was also relatively close to Brandy's house, he said, about a quarter mile away. Diane Guzman, a crime lab analyst with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, testified that she examined those items found in the trash can. She said the white t-shirt tested negative for blood, although there were red and brown dried stains all over it. She agreed that when DNA is badly degraded, it's possible to get a negative blood test. But she did get a positive blood test on the white collared shirt that was found in the trash can. She said there was unknown male DNA on the shirt, which she compared to the victims and to Henry. Everyone was excluded. Kevin Knoppinger, a DNA forensic scientist, testified about the DNA found on the phone in Brandy's master bedroom, He said Henry and Javonte were excluded, but he could not exclude Angel Avila. In fact, he said the DNA had genetic markers that had a 1 in 15,000 match to Avila. That would mean about 99.5% of the Hispanic population would be excluded, he said. Jason Bundy, the forensic quality manager at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or FDLE, testified that the partial profile developed from the swab of the bath bar in the bathroom where the children were found was not suitable for interpretation. Remember that during the prosecution's case, they called on Dr. McElfresh, who testified that the DNA contained a mixture from Brandy, Tamaya, Tanaya, and Henry. Bundy disagrees.
So finding that Mr. Segura would be included would not be based on reliable and tested practices and procedures within the scientific community.
That's definitely not approved in the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's procedure, and that was something that we tested, so it doesn't fulfill any of the requirements of our validations or our procedures.
Joellen Brown, another DNA analyst with the FDLE, was also recalled to the stand. This time, she testified about DNA found on the phone cradle from Brandy's master bedroom. She said she compared it to Angel Avila's DNA and that he was included as a contributor. Brown also tested the 6 latex gloves that were found in the trash can in the park a week after the murders. She couldn't get any DNA results, but they did test positive for blood. She said touch DNA was never requested for them, nor for the other items found in the trash can. She found limited DNA on the gray gloves, but she could only make exclusions based on that. She excluded Henry and all 4 victims. She said there were also 5 hairs that were submitted, but that Tallahassee investigators did not request for those to be tested. Greg Maimoni, an analyst also with the FDLE, examined footwear impressions from the scene. He said he received 10 impressions to examine. With 9 of them, he was unable to definitely determine that they were footwear impressions. He said many of them had characteristics of footwear impressions, but he couldn't say for sure. One of them, however, he called apparent footwear. All 10 were compared with samples from the first responders at the scene, and all were excluded. On cross, Prosecutor Fuchs brought up something Prince had said in his opening statement, that 5 sets of shoe prints were found at the scene.
Nothing in your analysis indicates that there are 5 different types of impressions or footprints of shoes going in all different directions, is there?
No.
Tamika Hawkins' prior testimony was played for the court. She could not testify in person due to medical reasons. She had a daughter with Henry a few years prior to the murders. She said she obtained a child support judgment against him for about $20,000. At some point, she said she had him thrown in jail, and another time, his driver's license was suspended. She also obtained a lien against any tax refunds he would receive. After she got the child support judgment against him, he came to mediation with her, and because of his efforts, the judgment was reduced by about $10,000. She said Henry never seemed bitter or resentful towards her or her daughter. In fact, they had a very positive relationship, she said. Michael Lafort, a crime scene reconstructionist, testified that due to the blood spatter and positioning, he said the object Brandy was beaten with would be something fairly wide, similar to a baseball bat. He said a firearm could have been used to inflict some of her injuries where the impact spatter was on the lower parts of the walls. But the impact spatter that was about 8 or 9 feet above the floor on the walls, there was no way a firearm could have done that, he said. Michael Knox, another expert, also testified about the scene. He said he believes a struggle started in Brandy's bedroom and then moved towards the living room and foyer, due to the amounts of blood stains and patterns. He said they increased dramatically while moving from the bedroom and said it appeared as though Brandy ran from the room. Knox also testified about things he said investigators missed, a drop of blood that could have been from the attackers but wasn't tested, a bracelet that was found on the floor that wasn't tested, and an unlocked bathroom window that he said should have been swabbed, but wasn't. The state presented a rebuttal to the defense. They called Major Anne Marie Johnson with the Tallahassee Police Department to the stand, who said she interviewed Henry Segura during his second interview. During his testimony, Henry had stated that he had talked to an officer with the last name Johnson on the phone after his arrest, and that he had told her that he had been over to Brandy's house on the day of the murders in order to have sex with her. Major Johnson said that did not happen.
Did he ever tell you at any time, I'm talking before arrest, during the investigation, after arrest, did he ever tell you at any time that he went to Brandy Peters' house on November 19th for any time or at any time or for any reason?
No, he did not.
Brandy's sister, Monica, was again called to the stand. She said that in February 2000, Brandy was 17 years old and didn't have a driver's license at that time. She said Brandy didn't get her license until she was 20 and didn't get a car until 2006 when she was 23. As you'll recall, James Santos said he met Brandy in 2000 or 2001 and that she agreed to drive and do drug runs for him.
You told us in your last testimony last week that, you know, you guys were obviously sisters and y'all were sisters who talked and saw each other on a daily basis, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Did Brandy ever deal or transport drugs?
No, ma'am.
Did she ever disappear for days at a time for out-of-town trips?
No, ma'am.
Had she ever been to Texas?
No, ma'am.
Had she ever even been, I mean, was she somebody who had been very many places at all outside of Tallahassee and North Florida?
No, ma'am.
She said Brandy didn't have much money and didn't have a flashy lifestyle. In fact, she lived in Section 8 housing and received food stamps from the government. Before that, she lived in a housing project. On cross, Prince pointed out that Brandy had dated a man named Kenny, who was in custody at the same time and place as James Santos was. Jason Newlin, an investigator with the state attorney's office, said he first had contact with James Santos in 2012. There was a court proceeding in 2015 where Angel Avila's name was first mentioned in the case. That hearing was covered by the media, and Avila's name was in the media coverage. Newlin said he and investigator Lewis interviewed Santos the day after that hearing. Santos said he had never heard of Angel Avila before. He said they showed him a photo of Angel Avila, and he said he did not recognize him. Then, about 7 months later, in January 2016, Santos brought up the name Angel Avila. Santos had given a sworn statement to the defense. Newlin said that typically, Santos's statements and letters he had written to the court about his involvement were all written, and this one was typed. After that, they located Angel Avila, who was living in Italy. Through a translator, they spoke to him. He said they had to use a translator because Avila doesn't speak English at all. In August of 2017, Santos then sent another letter to the court and brought up the name of Demario Paramore. This was about a week or two after another court proceeding where Paramore's name was first mentioned. That hearing was also covered by the media.
So both Angel Avila and Mr. Paramore, both of them mentioned by Mr. Santos, but both of those were first brought to the attention after court proceedings and or interviews in which those names were brought to him.
Correct.
Newlin also told the court that about a week ago, he went to visit Santos to see if he really spoke Spanish.
We have an intern in our office that's Venezuelan and speaks Spanish. Took her out there and I didn't say a word, let her communicate with him in Spanish, and he did not understand a single thing that was said to him.
On cross, Newlin said in 2015, when he interviewed Santos about whether he knew Angel Avila and Santos said no, Santos did mention a man by the name of Quinones, which is part of Avila's name, Angel Avila Quinones. Santos had said Quinones was a drug trafficker who funneled his drugs through Atlanta. Patrick Sanford, a special agent with the FBI, testified that he helped locate Angel Avila in 2016, who was living in Italy. He said he traveled there to get his DNA, which Avila gave voluntarily. He was very cooperative, he said. He went back a week before the trial to meet with him again so they could videotape his testimony. He was asked how tall Angel Avila is. He said he's around 5'7" or 5'8", somewhere around there.
Would you classify him as a tall, skinny Colombian?
No, not at all.
He said he had to use a translator when meeting with Avila. The prosecution then played the videotaped testimony. Angel Avila testified that he has never tried to bring drugs into the United States. He said he was the captain on a boat on its way to meet another boat from Mexico when he was apprehended by U.S. authorities about 450 miles out to sea from Acapulco, Mexico. The boat had drugs on it from Peru. He said he left the United States after being deported on April 8, 2009, about a year and a half prior to the murders. He said he doesn't know anyone by the name of James Carlos Santos or his alias. He said he has also never even been in the United States, except while in custody. The state also played testimony from Kelsey Kennard, who is currently unavailable to testify in person, despite prosecutors' efforts to get him into court. Kelsey was one of Henry's cellmates, and he said Henry confessed to him in 2001. He said Henry told him that he had killed four people. He had killed his baby's mom because they were going through child support issues or something like that. He said Henry was upset because she had more money than him. He said he shot Brandy and one of the kids and then drowned two of them. He said Henry even wrote a rap song about the murders, how he had killed her and the kids, and how he was nothing to be played with. He said Henry told him that the gun was in the motor of an old car that was at his wife's house. Henry also told him about an old girlfriend he had. He said he had asked her for her gun before the murders, but that she had turned him down. Henry told him that if he got out, he would then go kill her too. Kelsey told the court that he reported Henry's statements to investigators because, one, he's a father, and two, as part of his plea deal, if he has any knowledge of any criminal activity and doesn't report it, he could be prosecuted for it. In his closing arguments, prosecutor John Fuchs told the jury that Henry had the means, motive, and opportunity. He said James Santos is unreliable. He's previously confessed to multiple murders he didn't do, he said. He pointed out that Henry had 8 years to go over every piece of evidence in the case, and he asked the jury to find him guilty. In his closing arguments, Nate Prince again casted doubt on the state's timeline of the murders. He said they presented evidence that Brandy's sister had spoken to Brandy the night before. He pointed out that the state has never retrieved Brandy's home phone records to check that. Prince also said that they know Brandy and Santos were actively communicating with each other. He said when investigators searched her house, they found 7 or 8 letters from Santos to Brandy in the weeks leading up to her murder. He showed the jury the envelope from the letter Brandy had shown to her friend Cecily the day before the murders.
What it says on the back of this envelope is death before dishonor. Word is bond, bond is life, and a man should give his life before his word fails. Say what you mean and mean what you say. And it says below that, dear Mr. Mailman, if this letter happens to get lost, just send it to heaven because it's going to an angel. On the other side, it says, I thank God for you, and I ask that he look out for you and our three little angels. Chilling, right?
He said Cecily testified that Brandy was scared by that letter. She knew what it meant. He said Santos had testified that he was also emailing Brandy from another inmate's account. In those emails, Santos does appear to be writing in code or saying things that don't make sense. But Prince said Brandy knew what he was saying. On November 12th, 2010, Brandy responded to one of the emails, quote, I'm not trying to get fuck up about no BS. I need to know what is going on, so before I send pic or write back, I want to know his real name, date of birth, and why he was really there. My life means a lot to me, as well as my three kids. On November 17th, 2 days before the murders, Brandy responded, quote, "Tell Kalo that I really, really need to talk to him ASAP. If not, I'm going to do some crazy shit, and I know he don't want that. I'm going crazy right now, so he needs to let me know something because I don't play with me and my kids' life."
These are her words. Who knows best what Brandy's in danger from? Brandy does. Brandy knows best what Brandy's in danger from. You don't want to believe Santos? Don't believe Santos. Believe Brandy. You don't want to believe the shoe impressions. You don't want to believe the DNA. You don't want to believe the blood spatter. You don't want to believe the cell phone stuff. You don't want to believe Henry. All that's fine. Believe the one person who the state won't cross-examine. Believe the one person who is unimpeachable. Brandy Peters. She knew what she was in danger from. She knew best what she was in danger from. Her words alone, as are many of the other pieces of evidence I've talked about, are reasonable doubt in and of themselves.
The jury took a little under 4 hours to come back with their verdict.
State of Florida versus Henry Segura, we the jury find as follows. As count one of the indictment concerning the murders of Brandy Peters, the jury finds the defendant is guilty of first-degree murder.
He was found guilty of all counts. Henry didn't show much of a reaction when the verdict was read aloud, but his attorney, Nate Prince, hung his head. Henry Segura was sentenced to life in prison. The jury had spared him the death penalty. And that's all for this episode. Did you find this as head-scratching as I did? I'd love to know your thoughts. Do you think Henry Segura should have been found guilty of the murders? Or do you think there was too much reasonable doubt? Did the system get it right? Or did the real killers get away with it? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And speaking of Instagram, I just did an Instagram live show with the ladies from the Women in Crime podcast, where we talked about all things Jodi Arias, the crime, the trial, the updates, etc. Now, Jodi Arias is a topic that is frequently requested for me to cover on this podcast, but I've refrained from doing it because there are already so many great pods that have covered it. And to be honest, I don't really have much to add. But hopefully, for those of you who are interested in that case, you'll enjoy the Instagram Live, which is now posted on my Instagram page. I'm also planning on doing more lives in the future, so make sure you're subscribed to Court Junkie on Instagram. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.